Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today, we're turning our sights to Belarus, which is an issue I am sure many of our Brussels Sprouts listeners are following closely. And I have to say, it is remarkable to see that the large-scale protests that erupted after the fraudulent elections in early August are still continuing, show little sign of dissipating despite the brutal crackdowns that we've seen from the regime. But I think there's a lot of questions surrounding events in Belarus. You know, how long can Lukashenko hold on, given that he has virtually no legitimacy left among Belarusians? Why have we not seen cracks in the security services? Are they likely to stay loyal? What is Russia's thinking and calculus on this? I mean, I think all of the questions about how events are likely to evolve are top of mind for many. And to address these really important questions, we have two fantastic guests who are joining us today. We're joined by Judy Dempsey and Jonathan Katz. So welcome to you both.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Just very quick bios, get this out of the way. Judy, I'll start with you. Judy Dempsey is a senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, which is part of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's the editor of the policy blog Strategic Europe, and she's also a veteran journalist, having reported on European issues for the Financial Times, International Herald Tribune, The Economist. And also Jonathan, who is a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, where he directs the fund's democracy initiatives. And he previously served as a deputy assistant administrator of USAID's Europe and Eurasia group. So welcome to you both. And I know I was kind of racking my mind about where we should start, but maybe Jonathan, we can just start with you. Just a little lay down of events of where we are. And then Judy, hear a little bit about from you kind of where we are on the Europe side, how they have responded to what's happening.
Great. Well, just thank you so much for the invitation to discuss Belarus and to be here with Judy too, who is really, I read what you're writing and your colleagues as well. And you guys do a fantastic job. And CNAS also too. To be fair, my wife is also a member.
Given that disclaimer at the top.
She's a member of the CNAS family. So it's great to be here. But I think all of us have been sort of watching Belarus with real amazement. Really, one, my heart goes out to Belarusians who are really brave. Protesting. We're now over 50 plus days. It's been since August 9th. There was an election, a fraudulent presidential election, so clearly fraudulent that, just like you said in sort of your opening statement, that the international community, what you're seeing really coalescing, both in the EU, the United States, Canada, Great Britain, and others, is really looking at this election in Belarus and understanding for what it is, which is a fraudulent election. But this event that took place, the election, the fraudulent nature of the election, and what's taken place after, which has been protesters coming to the streets in historic numbers in Belarus, is truly historic. And this is really about Belarus and the future of Belarus. And I think what you see is protesters continuing to ask for new elections, release of political prisoners. You've seen tens of thousands of Belarusians who've been detained violently. Some have been killed, and what they're asking for today, still today, is an end to this repression, an end to a dictator who's been in power for 26 years, Alexander Lukashenko. And I think what you're seeing right now is in some sense, people call it a stalemate. The people are still on the street in an amazing way, and you saw it this past weekend again and continuing day after day. And you really see a coalescing of the international community as well. And you see the opposition leader traveling to meet with Macron, will be meeting with Merkel. And each place that she goes is a clear message from the European side. Some people would like it to be clear. And we can go into the issue of sanctions and from the American side as well, that everyone wants to see new elections. The view that Lukashenko is no longer a legitimate leader, and that let's give the Belarusian people an opportunity to choose their own future. There's a Moscow component to it, which we can talk about, obviously, because of the connection between the two. And since August 9th, it's been quite clear that Mr. Putin, much like he does in these regions, finds a willing partner, one that he's worked with, not in the most perfect way for the last 26 years. But Lukashenko is finding his support coming from Moscow and little else elsewhere. So you look internally what's happening in Belarus, and you don't see his power base growing. One tool that he has is repression and violence. And then he is backed by Moscow. We can go into the various ways in which that form of support takes place. So here we are, 50 plus days later, with a situation of protests, Lukashenko not leaving. And so we're all trying to look into our crystal balls and how this situation moves forward in a peaceful way. And this is what Belarusians are asking, is for a peaceful transition. And so I think that gives you a little sense of where we are, but there's so many components to it. And I know Judy is likely to pick up on different parts of it, and you as well. But again, my heart goes out to those Belarusians who have been protesting and seeking a change after 26 years. And we can't forget that COVID-19 has played a particular role in this, as it has in other countries too, where you see leaderships that don't respond well to the pandemic being impacted politically. And of course, Lukashenko's response, which was utterly ridiculous, and seen by many, was a catalyst in pushing, not the only catalyst in pushing Belarusians to protest, but it played a significant role.
That's great, Jonathan. And so Judy, how would you describe what the kind of reaction has been on from the Europeans so far?
I think we have to be quite cautious with the reaction, because it's actually not a uniform reaction in terms of a gut reflex. Very briefly, the Baltic states are very, very, very strong in supporting Belarus, especially Lithuania. And Lithuania has a very special relationship with Belarus over the years. They offered students a special university in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. They've always had a hands-on support for activists and for democratic activists and for the opposition in Belarus. And further afield, what you have in Europe is symptomatic of the fault lines in Europe. Because Europe is never united, because the European member states have different perceptions of threats and different perceptions of challenges. So Belarus, for the Greeks, Spaniards, Portuguese, Maltese, Italians, doesn't matter, it's far away. What interests them and their threat is migration, or the Mediterranean. Up in the north, the Nordics are very passionate about Belarus. They see this as a major threat because of Russia, and because it's their neighbor, and because they see what's at stake in terms of stability. And then we have the bigger countries. Jonathan referred to them. We have Germany, we have France, we have the Netherlands, and we have Britain, which is leaving the EU, unfortunately. And these big countries are very, very important. And they don't want blanket sanctions on Belarus. And they will do these sanctions on Lukashenko. But you know what? So what? It doesn't matter. These people don't travel in any case to Europe. And the EU imposed sanctions before on the top leadership, and it didn't make a difference. And then it lifted them, and then they put them back again and lifted them. And in my view, the sanctions are more a moral, symbolic act. And so we are left with the situation of two tracks. The one track, which Jonathan mentioned, which is very, very important, that this is a very special revolution. It's not going to stop. And the women in white, it reminds me of Argentina, but they will do this every Saturday. They're doing it today. The students, the workers, the factory workers, everybody, the IT workers, everybody is out there. And they're going to do it every Sunday, and the police forces will crack down. I'm not so sure how long this crackdown will last, but this will continue. We have this track. And the parallel track is a European one. And the European track shouldn't be rocket science. And this is, I believe this is what the Europeans should do. And I must say that the Europeans are not in an easy situation. They're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't because of Lukashenko and Putin. If they openly support and say, we've got to go in and democratize, of course, Putin will use this as an excuse to ramp up the pressure and support Lukashenko. If the Europeans don't do anything, they will be blamed for not doing anything. So the Europeans have to do a very careful use of soft power. And the European Union actually is, first of all, they've got no hard power, and they're pretty bad on soft power, but this is their chance to do soft power. How? First of all, don't recognize the elections. Okay, so what are you going to do with Lukashenko? You actually, since he won't pick up the phone with Angela Merkel for the moment, the Europeans should actually reach out to the Coordinating Council and have a dialogue with them. Reach out to security forces, to the elites. You cannot ignore the elites in these countries. They're there. They're financed. Putin has given them some money as well. You cannot just ignore the status quo at the moment. And the status quo is very, very fragile because of these huge demonstrations. So the EU must support the Coordinating Council, must keep pressing for a dialogue. They must support in all sorts of ways the independent media through financing, through personnel, through manpower. We saw what Belsat is doing in Warsaw. Belsat is a super Belarusian satellite television, which is based out of Warsaw for the last 10 or 15 years. It's just fantastic. We've got to promote as much as promote the social media and tell the Belarusians and that we are with them. We're not going to play the devil's advocate and play into Putin's hands that, oh, you're going to join the EU and you're going to join NATO. No, this is your choice. And what your choice is, we will support you in all sorts of ways. Scholarship programs, supporting for the economy, even a Marshall Plan program. I mean, frankly, the meeting between President Putin and President Lukashenko was pretty dismal. Putin did not give him a huge amount of money. So this is a chance for the European Union to be inventive and creative and say, this is what we can offer you. We're not going to interfere. You have to decide what kind of country you want. Yes, the security forces are going to strike you more and more, but we are there and we will provide legal help, state help, social help for the media, and also we will actually monitor all the kinds of repressions that are going on and name names. Name names is very important. It's not about these people traveling or being sanctioned. It's about naming names and putting shame to these people who are actually beating innocent, peaceful protesters. This is a very important revolution. And this is my final point. This is one of the unfinished revolutions, one of the unfinished transitions that are taking place in Europe, our neighbor. It's 90 minutes ride from here in a plane.
Well, thank you for that. That was just a brilliant, both of you laid out just brilliantly the situation up there. And we could end the podcast right now, I think, and have a full story. But let me ask you, you know, what should the U.S. be doing? We've heard about what the Europeans should be doing and the various nations, whether they were in the South or whether they're the big countries of Europe. But in terms of the United States, what should we be doing? And let me make it a little bit easier by taking Donald Trump out of the picture. He's got an affinity towards Russia, so that complicates things. But if this were a normal U.S., what should we be doing? How could we have a play a role that would be effective? Jonathan first, and then Judy.
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. And when I look at the current, I know you're trying to remove Trump from the equation, but it's hard to do that when ultimately the decisions rise to the top. And I think, you know, I always think that in this administration that, you know, you know policymakers at state or NSC or others, if they are trying to get things done, maybe they don't want it to rise to the level where the president has to make a decision. We're like a little over a month away from the U.S. election, so it is a factor. But what I do think is that you are seeing a reaction from the U.S. Sometimes I look at this, I'd like to see the U.S. leading on these issues rather than, you know, leading a few steps from behind when it comes to Belarus or to this region. The president, for example, signed on to a letter, unsuspecting to me today, on Nagorno-Karabakh, which I wouldn't have expected that you would see something come out of the White House on that topic. But in Belarus, I think the things that we would like to see, and you know, those that are following this closely, following the administration, is some of the things that exactly what Judy laid out, which you are hearing from the State Department, Deputy Secretary Biegun, who I actually think in this case, for this particular issue, is a fairly good person to have. He knows the region, knows Moscow well. I think he went to Vilnius, met with the opposition leader, has been saying the right thing when you look at U.S. saying that they recognize this was a fraudulent election, recognizing that there will need to be new elections. I know they're contemplating the U.S. right now. Sanctions, there's already sanctions on the books that have never been completely removed. So there are already tools in place. And I agree with Judy, there's a limit to the impact of sanctions on Lukashenko directly and those that surround him as well. But areas where I'd like to see this be expanded would be spaces like Russia, because you see material support for Lukashenko and his crackdown and for oppression or for election violations, things coming directly from Russia in support of Lukashenko. And so I think what we're asking, and we saw it today in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which passed the Belarus Democracy Act, which is the third iteration of the Belarus Democracy Act, where it says, really says expand sanctions, but also targeting Russian actors in this. And I think it's really important. So you really want the diplomacy to be there. You want to see a transatlantic component to this. I think it's somewhat there. We're seeing sanctions being rolled out over the last couple of days from Great Britain, from Canada. My understanding is that the EU, that there will be some sort of deal moving forward. Maybe I should be sort of crossing my fingers right now that will happen and that they'll overcome the issue involving Cyprus and sort of Eastern Med, which is a whole issue in and of itself. But I think if the U.S. is rowing with its transatlantic partners, if it's providing additional support, I'd like to see, and I think others would, more support for civil society, for independent media. We see some great efforts to document the human rights abuses that are taking place. That will be critical going forward. Judy also mentioned the economic component to this. Belarus is in a very difficult economic situation. Several months ago, the IMF was looking to come in with a package of support, macroeconomic support. I've and others have said, hold off IMF, even though it's needed. Pouring good money after bad with Lukashenko does not make sense, but they're in a bad way. And I think if the international community, particularly the EU and US together, along with the IMF, if there is a transition, is prepared to provide significant support under the right circumstances, that's important. And I think my expectation too, sort of building in Judy, is that you're going to see a transition from this coordination council to something more demonstrative in the coming days and weeks from Belarusian opposition to explain exactly the direction that they would like to go. Because the ultimate question is, how do you transition from this moment to the next? And I think those that are on the street in Belarus and externally want to get a better sense of how this opposition and those seeking transition are going to be able to carry this out, what the figures might look like, what their plans might be. And I think it's putting more flesh on the bones to, you know, an opposition, you know, half a year ago that maybe didn't exist in this way. So I think those are some of the areas where I think the U.S. can lead, has provided some support, but the levels of resources have always been particularly low over the last several years for Belarus. And we really need to reshape how we think about the Belarusian people wanting to have their own future. And I think we were very much caught up in a game that there would be no change in Belarus, no chance for change. Why should we be putting our resources into a situation where there would be no change? That's clearly different today. And I agree with Judy. This is not the protest will not end, and the efforts of those that are protesting to seek this change is not going to end anytime soon.
Judy, do you want to add anything? That was pretty comprehensive. It's a hard act to follow.
I think we can throw in another question. I mean, if you want, I mean, Jonathan, you kind of raised this issue of like, how do you get from this moment to the next and kind of having a vision for where the transition might go? Judy, what sense do you get from Tikhanovskaya or others in the opposition about where they do want to go? Has she made sounds that Moscow will find acceptable? Do you think Moscow is in the background looking to find someone else who they might find more acceptable? Where do you get the sense of where the opposition is headed and whether Moscow would find that acceptable?
It's a very good question. First of all, what we are seeing is an unfolding of activities which haven't been haven't been replicated in other countries. And in Belarus, and leaving aside the capital, Minsk, in the cities and the towns, you have extraordinary levels of the rise of citizens, the rise of what the citizens want. And it's not a coherent program, and it can't be after so many years of a dictatorship. It takes a long time to articulate what people want. But if you look at all the kind of demonstrations taking place right across Belarus, they have one thing in common. They want the truth. And then underneath this, they want new elections. And then underneath this, it's kind of the platform. They want just freedom, free media, democracy. Doesn't cost anything. Democracy doesn't cost money. It's a piece of paper for voting. They want this sort of issue. And they want the end of the lies. And lies and just not telling the truth has been the hallmark of the Lukashenko regime. And he's played us skillfully, the European Union against Russia and vice versa. But people have had enough of lies. I'm sitting here 30 years, where we are celebrating 30 years of German reunification. It's the end of lies. It's the end of deceit. It's the end of not being able to travel. It's the end of not being able to see the tide. Just very briefly, one of my first interviews after the wall came down, I visited a very elderly lady and I asked her, what do you want from this unification? And she said to me, Judy, I just want to see the tide. There was no tide in East Germany. It was the Ostsee. It was the Baltic Sea, and there's no tide in the Baltic Sea. She wanted to see the North Sea or the Mediterranean. She wanted the tide. And so the Belarusians want the tide, the political tide, of ebb and flow, of give and take, of just the truth. And it's something that the Americans and the West Europeans and the East Europeans and those under the EU have taken for granted. They just want enough. Interestingly, they don't talk about the EU or NATO. They just want an end to the deceit and to the lies. And just give us the freedom, and then we will manage it. And the Europeans should be very careful not to be arrogant or imposing. We should listen. And that's what we should do with our American friends as well. This is a big transatlantic challenge, because the transatlantic challenge since 1989 was to make Europe whole and free and safe. And Belarus is going to be a part of this.
One question, Judy, I love what you just said. But the one thing you said is democracy doesn't cost anything. But the one problem with that is it does cost something for the people at the top, right?
Of course.
So who are afraid of they benefited from the top. So this brings me to my question about elite support for the regime. And so far, they haven't shown any signs of defecting. They've been willing to crack down on protesters. But I wonder, I'd love to hear from you both what you think the prospects are for any elite divisions. And Judy, I mean, you've raised a point about how the West can help engender some of those divisions by naming and shaming and calling out and shining a light and using sanctions and trying to use some of those tools to drive those fissures within the elite. But what are the prospects? How long do you think the elite can continue to prop up Lukashenko, given that he really has no legitimacy left among the people?
Jonathan, do you want to take this? I would be very brief.
Go ahead.
It's a great question. If I were sitting in the Kremlin, and I'm not, I would do the calculations. And I would say, hang on, the Belarusians, they're not going to join the EU tomorrow. They're not going to join NATO tomorrow. I mean, frankly, it's a small country. Why don't I do a kind of Armenia solution for them? You know, go for somebody. Maybe I can deal with the opposition. Why not? And at the moment, the Belarusians are not that anti-Russian. They will become more anti-Russian the more Putin pours in support to arm the security services and beat the demonstrations. But if I was Putin, I would say, you know, frankly, I would much prefer a stable Belarusian leadership, you know, partly of my liking, but let them go a little bit more. But I don't think that's maybe the pragmatic element of the Kremlin at the moment. And the Kremlin has a huge number of problems internally and externally, especially now with Azerbaijan and Armenia. But I'm afraid that so much now depends on Russia's game plan, and Putin has no love for Lukashenko. Lukashenko has burned his boats, essentially, completely with the EU. Since Lukashenko is so beholden to Russia, if Putin was smart enough, he would say, okay, your days are numbered. Let's see what the Coordinating Council would do. But he can't go down that path, because then it would actually change the parameters of the changes in Russia as well.
You know, I completely agree. I mean, I don't see, I think, Judy, you speak to logic, and I think Putin's logic is quite different in how he has acted within Eastern Europe too, because he did more for Ukrainian self-identity, and now in Belarus as well, than anybody could do to strengthen that and strengthen that self-identity. And he's doing it again in Belarus. And so I think there, you know, I think he, if he was wise, he would turn to you as an advisor on this particular situation and listen
because I think he's going to repeat some of the same mistakes. And when you hear and speak to Belarusian opposition, that, you know, they always start off by saying, of course, this isn't about Russia. It's not about changing course with Russia. But they fully believe, many of them believe, that Putin has fully backed Lukashenko, and that, you know, and he's, so it's turning a situation that wasn't the case before into something. And so I still think that there's time, and I think that there is a calculation, both one which I don't think a lot of people have a lot of trust in, but feel that there's still an opportunity for Moscow to change course. And I think there's an effort on the diplomatic side from the West to ratchet up that pressure on Lukashenko to present what they hope will be the sign that Moscow needs to come to the table. I'm not convinced that this is going to happen, because there really is no, I don't know where the record is of Putin playing a positive role. And exactly as you said, I think because he fears democracy internally in Russia, although I suspect he doesn't believe it will happen, I don't believe that he'll allow for the Coordination Council to come to power.
Let's very briefly think out of the box. Let's the Coordinating Council, leave out the EU, leave out the Americans, some diaspora, have the elite, have a round table. This is a small country, and it's possible to make it a success and a piece of transition. This is my optimistic hat. Let's go the Polish way. Let's go with the 1989-1990 roundtable. And the Belarusian Coordinating Council, they're very smart. They know what's at stake. They know what they can do. They know what they can't do. They see what Russia's doing. And so off a roundtable. Okay, Lukashenko, it's going to be very difficult given all the tensions. There's thousands now detained, and there's been torture and everything else. It's been quite shocking, and we live in our comfort zone, and we can't imagine the courage these people are going through. But imagine if they said, okay, we're going to continue these demonstrations, but this is our program. Roundtable, you join us, give us your program, this is our program, and let's see how we're going to go from here. That's the pragmatic view. I don't think it would work. I would hope it would work. I'm not so sure the elite is ready for this, because, and this is a point I've been thinking about every time I walk the dog, if you're in power, and if you have omnipotent power for 25 years, you don't even have the language for negotiation. You don't have the means to conceptualize the idea of a dialogue. And you lose, you just don't simply have the means for this. And this is the downside of having the round table. But maybe there are people in the elite that can persuade Lukashenko to do this. But the more I think about it, authoritarian leaders, just by virtue of their authority, simply do not have the language or the cultural outlook or the political means to even engage in the idea of a dialogue, because the whole power base is against this.
Wow. Well, there is so much to think about. I think when you walk your dog, I think your dog comes away exhausted. This is just fabulous. Let's put on our pessimist's hat on, or at least the pragmatic hat on. If you were a military planner in the Baltics or in Poland, yeah. You're a military planner at Shape in Mons or up in Stuttgart with the European Command, and you were looking at a pessimistic scenario of the Russians actually, in some fashion, not necessarily tanks rolling over into the border, but the Russians getting involved and building a base, you know, that kind of thing, that which has been kicked around. What would you do? I mean, there are military planners having to think about this right now, just because they like to plan for even the even the worst case. And so, what would you say to your bosses? What would you say to these planners about what could happen or might not happen at all, and you shouldn't worry about it?
Well, I would say, Stuart, I think there is a real worry about this, and sort of initial steps to reclassify, military exercises from counterterrorism to one that is changing the nature of that cooperation between Belarus and Moscow. Already, this has happened. Border closures, concerns. So I think these are real, sort of real concerns. I know that, this is where, Jim, I'm sure you guys thought about this all the time, about the gap that exists between, in these spaces that separates the Balts and Poland. And I think a lot of people are concerned about it. What's really interesting is that more often than not, the security debate, has lagged behind, sort of the democracy and governance issues, protests. But I think it's worthwhile. I think it's why you see, Judy mentioned that this role of Lithuania, you're seeing the Poles as well. They're scared. There's historic reasons to be concerned. There's been an effort by Moscow in the past to move military bases in, which, by the way, in Belarus, which has been widely unpopular in Belarus, which tells you where the population. In fact, I think this is one of the issues that really brought a lot of attention to the fact that perhaps Belarus is not already part of Russia, that union state really isn't the direction when you start looking at polling numbers of how Belarusians feel about their relationship with Russia. This is one of the key issues really that has really been pronounced in terms of how people have viewed Belarus. And I think it's also part of the reason where you see and have seen, including this administration right now, where you see Bolton, the national security advisor, going to Minsk, where you're seeing Pompeo go to Minsk. I mean, there's a bit of egg on Pompeo's face for going in the beginning of the year and being where the situation is right now. But these are some of the reasons, these security reasons, let alone the energy sector, which is a whole separate conversation, where the U.S. and others are looking at the dynamics internally. And there's been some really important studies done about Russian hybrid aggression internally in Belarus, which kind of points to these tensions of how Belarusians view their relationship with Russia. But you asked about the military question. Of course, there's concerns. And I think that's why you're seeing Warsaw stepping up, the Baltic countries moving forward first on sanctions. They want to raise a level of concern because it's of a direct threat to them. And how the U.S., how the NATO, how the EU reacts on this subject matter directly impacts how they feel that reaction will be if something were to happen in Baltic countries, especially in a pre-election period in the United States. You see what's taking place in the South Caucasus as well, where you see this gap of leadership or attention. And I think rightfully so, people are raising the alarms. And so I think I wish we could spend the entire conversation focusing on the military aspect of this, because it deserves even greater attention.
I want to ask both of you, as two people who follow Belarus in this part of the world quite closely, how surprised are you that the protests are still ongoing? I guess what I'm getting at with that is, have there been changes in the last several years domestically in Belarus in terms of development of civil society or other dynamics that make you make you optimistic, or would you be more skeptical about the prospects that this could really be a transition? Like, what's going on in Belarus that helps explain? Obviously, there was a fraudulent election that was the trigger. But what were the kind of underlying factors that made this possible, that have been able to sustain the movement and then that help you think about what direction this might be headed?
Judy, do you want to jump in first, and I'll?
I'd be very brief, Jonathan. I couldn't agree more with you. In the military, we need a very long conversation on this. Super, NATO. Okay, very briefly, the Belarusians are tired of fraudulent presidential elections. I mean, this is they've had several, and the opposition have tried. The most important thing about this election is that the opposition came together. For the first time ever, after so many years of bickering and different outlooks and everything, the opposition came together. Three women brought it together from three completely different backgrounds, and this really shocked the regime. And because of this unity, this galvanized the whole of the society. That the fact that they all spoke with one voice, three women, you know, were going this together, and they brought the society together. This is a big change, very, very important. Secondly, it's not only the fraudulent elections. Actually, it's the way the corona pandemic was dealt with. Lukashenko, oh, you know, drink vodka, or it's not a big deal, blah, blah, blah. And people said, I mean, I'm sorry, what's going on here? This is an epidemic. What happened? Civil society galvanized. Masks were put together. By the way, there was nothing in the hospitals, no information, nothing, no disinfectant, nothing. And civil society got together to protect themselves. They got the masks ready, they sewed the masks, they had their own network. Corona was a fantastic catalyst for the civil society. It was very, very exciting. And it was very hard for the regime to actually stop people from wearing masks and getting themselves organized. But in fact, the organization of the civil society because of corona was hugely important. And in some ways, it prepared them for the fraudulent elections. So two things, very briefly, fed up with lies over the elections. And secondly, even more fed up with that you're damaging our health and you don't give a toss about it. So we're going to deal with ourselves and we're going to deal with the elections. And here we are. And it's not going to stop. It's on a roll. Civil society is something very special. We've got lazy about it in Europe and perhaps in the United States. But I mean, there are pockets all over Europe in all sorts of ways, but it's on the ascendancy in Belarus. It's theirs. And they don't want to be hijacked by Russia. They don't want to be hijacked by the Americans. They don't want to be hijacked by the Europeans. It is theirs. And they're going to make it their new movement. And hopefully, I have to be partisan on this naturally, and hopefully they're going to turn this around.
Yeah, I agree with Judy too. I mean, this idea that, you know, that protests post elections aren't new in Belarus. I mentioned the Belarus Democracy Act was passed in the mid 2000s after 2010 elections. Again, now sort of documenting what took place. But one thing you said, Judy, earlier that struck me is that Belarusian one, I think self identity, but the idea that as they are citizens, able to do things in their communities. And so that's been on the rise, sort of this self-identity with self-awareness. And I think COVID was one of the catalysts I mentioned earlier. Obviously locking up and jailing some popular vloggers, those that were, you know, that tried to run, that led to the troika of women sort of leading this movement, which is extraordinary. I mean, just how this happened is extraordinary. But I also want to just, you know, point out that there's economic issues that were driving this COVID-19, but also even before that, within the population, the economy has not been doing well and was hit considerably. And the other one is tech companies, which we, you know, I think is really important. I had an opportunity to go to that, meet with the tech sector when I was at USAID, go to this high tech center that was set up.
And you could see in that that private sector spirit in that particular sector, a Belarus that was changing, younger Belarusians that were very external looking, worldly, and doing incredibly well. And so I think it's really important. And you're seeing today Lukashenko actually going after those tech leaders and those tech leaders fighting back. And I think when you talk about communications, one of the things that Lukashenko did not count for was the ability for civil society and those protesting to overcome communication obstacles that he put up. So we all hear about Telegram. We hear about the efforts, despite the fact that Lukashenko has shut down portions of the internet or communication, for the ability for them to overcome this. And there's external support for this as well, but they don't need it. They have their own creativity, the own skills to do this. And it's something that has, I think, is something that will be quite unique about this, is what they have done. You do also see this in movements like in Hong Kong and elsewhere globally, but they're really, you guys still there? They're really smart, and they know what they're doing. I think it's really important to recognize these generation gaps and these sectors that have played an important role. And that doesn't discount what you see amongst workers at state-owned enterprises, because I think seeing all walks of life from Belarus participating, and of course those state-owned enterprises, those workers are struggling now because they're not being allowed to strike and do the things they want, but they're right there. So I think these are things that you see that are different today than previously, but the underpinnings of this were growing, you know, whether it's civil society or even the independent media, when you talk about Belsat or others, it was there. And so hopefully that those resources, that effort will continue.
So maybe we can end just with on one final question, and kind of do a speed round. But I mean, we all know that transitions are messy. They are very difficult to predict. So rather than asking you to get out your magic ball that you referred to, I think, in your opening thing, Jonathan, I want to, as two people who have spent a lot of time, again, watching this, what are the factors that you think are going to be most important in shaping the future trajectory? What are you, as you're reading news and seeing developments coming out of Belarus and in Europe and in the West, what are you paying most attention to, because you think that they're going to be the key factors that drive this forward? What should we all be watching?
Judy, you want to go first?
No, Jonathan, you go first.
Well, the things I think that we should be watching, one is the protest, the strength, continued strength of protest in Belarus, how those protests compare and versus Lukashenko's the immovable object of somebody who, like Judy said, doesn't even know the language of compromise, doesn't know how to, and doesn't want to, because he doesn't know anything different. So looking at the protests, the strength, but really at the Coordination Council, this group set up externally that is, it's not the representative of the government. I don't think that they purport to be, but they speak for the Belarusian people in terms of aspirations. How that group will transition over the next couple of weeks from the Coordination Council to maybe another body set up to lay out how a peaceful transition might look like, how they might deal with, these are Belarusians, how they might deal, and this could come from Belarusian diaspora, it could be people coming in that have a great deal of credibility to tackle the problems that Belarus has, because I still think that there are some in Europe, whether it's in Brussels or Washington, who look at that movement and, you know, say, well, who's responsible for taking it to the next step? Who are we supporting? So I look at what's taking place in Belarus, both internally, those who are outside trying to take the next steps in terms of a transition, what that plan looks like, looking again at how the West is building up response, whether we talk about support, assistance for, you know, continued support for civil society or media, or we look at sanctions or diplomatic messaging. So there's a Western component external that will continue to play a role. We'll see how that plays out. It could look very different from the U.S., depending on what happens during the election and approach to this. And then also on the European side, and how that support will continue to change. And I think I agree. There's all different voices within the EU. We saw this with Ukraine. It's not monolithic, but more often than not, whether it comes to a conclusion, the EU, as we see on sanctions, it looks like it's unanimous in at least wanting to move forward. It's unanimous in providing support, whether the level is the right level or not. That's another story. So looking at those factors, and then Moscow, you know, how is if the situation remains protracted, you know, is there space for Moscow? I'm not a believer that Mr. Putin will do anything that's not in his own interest in Belarus. I'm really not optimistic. I want to be, but I think that factor, the longer that Putin plays the role of Lukashenko's supporter, the more he will lose in Belarus, the more it will be difficult for them to play a role that they might want to play. And I heard George Kent, when he came, Deputy Assistant Secretary, came, spoke at an event that we put on about this, and he really spoke to this and said, you know, Russia is really, you know, it's hurting itself. And I've heard this from, you know, sort of U.S. officials saying, we're trying to tell these guys, hey, you're gonna only hurt your own interests. But I don't think that's the way Mr. Putin thinks. And I think that there's a number of other factors involved. And he's obviously, Mr. Putin is looking at the outcome of our election in the United States as well to determine his next move. So we may have to wait several weeks before we see any type of change from Moscow.
Judy, anything you want to add on top? That was great, Jonathan. Thank you.
Last word.
Oh, gosh. Russia has to decide. And Lukashenko has to decide if they want a peaceful transition. It's the bottom line. Is Belarus that important for Putin to cause so much havoc? I don't know if he has the imagination after being so long in power. And this gets back to my original argument about power. If you're so long in power and you're autocratic, you actually lose the means to negotiate and to have a dialogue and to have compromises. And in some ways, Belarus is a big test case for this. It really, really is. And I think about this more and more, that autocratic leaders just don't have the language or the culture or the experience. Are the elites or the people to advise them? Unless they can make this huge leap. And so it's unfinished. This transition, this transformation is only beginning in Belarus. And because of Putin's situation and how he sees power and Lukashenko's, we're in for a long haul. And I must say it's going to be up to the civil society to do this. And it's going to be up to the European Union and the European member states to be savvy and careful, pragmatic and helpful and humane and moral in how to deal with this unfinished business.
Beautiful.
Well, that is a wonderful note to end on, Judy. Jonathan and Judy, thank you very much for helping us wade our way through all of this. It is a remarkable event. You guys have laid it out just very useful way. And I think all of our listeners will appreciate that. We've also just not even to forget how much ground we've covered in this conversation. I mean, we did start solving the problem first. It kind of took us down the rabbit hole. We had it solved. But then I think we put a lot of substance to the conversation and really kind of talked about what's driving events and how consequential they are. So thank you very much for the conversation.
Yeah, it was a good pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Jim.
Good to see you.
Maybe think a great deal. Thanks a lot.